5,734 this coming year may bring us oil rationing. Now, these two facts are not integrally related, but they have provided the administration with a ready technique by which to divert attention from its own sins of arrogance. So much so that one of the columnists was moved to use an old rubric in a contemporary setting to speak of the conversation about the oil crisis as pouring oil on troubled waters. Now, oil will certainly be the central issue in international politics and economics this year and for many years to come. The oil-consuming nations show no desire to abate their appetites. The oil-producing nations have made it clear that they want something more than gold bullion to place in Swiss banks in exchange for their black gold. But there is now a political price for oil, at least in the case of the Arab states. This political price is the weakening of economic and political support for Israel, Israel's head. And since time immemorial, trade in oil and thought about oil has preoccupied man. Indeed, in a series of negotiations which have quite a contemporary ring to them, King Solomon secured the lumber that he required for the building of the temple in Jerusalem, the beams of cedar and the beams of cypress, by exchanging 20,000 bushels of wheat and 20 liquid tons of oil with Hiram, king of Tyre, for the wood that he wanted. Men have thought about oil and traded in oil for a long time. And in this coming year, which will be lived out under the sign of oil, it may be useful to us to spend a few minutes this evening recalling their thoughts and reliving with them their concerns. Perhaps their thoughts and their concerns have some bearing on our concerns and our thoughts. The biblical word for oil is shemen. Like the oil of modern times, which is used primarily for motion and for heating, oil in ancient days was used as a base for medicines and for perfumes. Some baking was done with oil, but primarily oil was used for lighting. Anyone who has dug in the Middle East has found these small, shallow, bowl, pottery oil lamps. There, they existed there by the tens of thousands, and they provided what they had by way of a means of alleviating the darkness. Oil was then, as now, a precious commodity. A man, a city, a nation which had a surplus of oil, reserves of oil, was rich. Indeed, oil became one of the terms which symbolized wealth and riches. The adjective shamain, from the noun shemen, meant in turn rich, as in a rich man, fertile, as in a fertile field, and fat, full, abundant. Oil then has now represented all the wealth of the world. And Moses wanted to express to the children of Israel the blessedness of the land which the Lord their God was giving them. He said it is an Eretz Zeit Shemen Udvash, a land in which there is much oil and much honey. Some 700 years later, when the prophet Joel wanted to describe to a congregation the blessedness of the Messianic age, he said it was a time when the threshing floors are heavy with wheat, when the vats are full of wine and with oil. And in a process which obviously began in a form of sympathetic magic, the kings of Israel, on their inauguration, were anointed with oil, hoping in this way that having their physical frame drenched in wealth and riches as its symbol, their reign, their rule, would similarly be abundant and rich and prosperous. And tonight, as we wish each other a Shana Tova, we have many things in mind, do we not? We wish for our friends and our loved ones health and well-being, life. We wish for our world and for ourselves peace, and domestic security and tranquility. And we wish to everyone we know, if not abundance, certainly sufficiency. For there is no virtue in poverty, and there is no blessedness in being needy. But from the very beginning, our sages insisted that we see wealth, oil, and all that it represents as something less than the ultimate goal and purpose in life. When the author of the book of Ecclesiastes wanted to express the incomparable value of that sense of worth, of personal peace of mind, of integrity, of character, which is a blessing beyond price, he compared it to wealth, and he said, Tov Shem Mishemen Tov. A good name is incomparably more valuable than the best of oils, than good oil. And the Midrash elaborates at length on the comparison. Good oil evaporates. A good name endures. A good oil must be used in order to have any value, and ultimately it's used up. A good name remains, however long you are known by it. Good oil is precious. It can be acquired only by the rich. A good name can be acquired by the rich man or the modest man or the poor man. It's independent of a person's income. Tov Shem Mishemen Tov. And in one of those uncanny ways in which life has a way of illustrating the Bible, if we take this text literally, and it was obviously meant as metaphor as well as literally, we find a classic illustration of how seldom men and nations abide by this basic moral truth. In 1967, in a fit of moralism, France declared that she would not truck with any of the belligerents in the Middle East. She was for peace, and they were fighting. So France, as you recall, imposed an arms embargo on all the nations which were involved in the 1967 war. But France wanted Libyan oil, and Libya wanted French supersonic planes and sensitive missiles. And though Gaddafi proclaimed quite openly that these missiles and these planes would be staffed and manned by Egyptian soldiers and used against Israel when the time came, France preferred to be a hypocrite, to close its eyes to reality, to set profit, oil, above principle. And so I'm afraid it is with most nations and most people most of the time. And before we begin to believe that it's only over there that men sin, let's remember that the oil pinch has only begun to impose itself here on our nation. And it's not at all clear that the profits of the international oil cartels or the great banks will not impress upon our government to the point where it feels it advisable to withdraw some of the support which until now it has had for a sister democracy in another part of the world. We say easily, a good name is worth more than wealth, prosperity, all that oil represents. But I wonder how many of us really live by this code. Which of the words would you choose to fit your own life? I always, generally, occasionally, rarely set principle above personal advantage. I know that I'm not measured by my net worth, but what I feel within to be my worthwhileness as a human being. And there's a ready rationalization, is there not, for every occasion on which we set profit above principle. There's a great big cold world out there, and I have many duties to myself and to my family, and I must live in such a way as to discharge these duties. It's a jungle, and sometimes I need to be an animal. In diplomats are supported in order to write white papers to explain the black deeds which their country takes on in order to get the black gold, in order to get the profits which the country wants. And so it is with us, all too often. The conventional morality in America is one which measures a man's worth by his net worth. And if there's something suspicious about his net worth, he can easily, given our society, gain a good character by giving some of this net worth to some worthwhile charity, and then he is honored in the community as one of its most respected citizens. In America, I'm afraid, Shane told me, Shemin told, that a good name is better than the best of oils, is assumed to be a choice which we do not have to make. We can have a good name and profit also. And so we see in our nation our senior leaders, our president lecturing us from time to time on civics, at the same time that he is building up through friends who enjoy the friendship of the powerful $10 million worth of real estate. And we see the Vice President of the United States lecturing welfare mothers on the Protestant work ethic, at the same time that his larder and his bar are being filled by friends and assumedly his pocketbook. And so it is with them and with us. We have been told by a billion-dollar industry that the way to happiness is the good life. And in America, the good life is defined by the things we own, the amenities which we can purchase, the dresses which we can put on our back, the places that we can go, the experiences that we can have, all things which involve the monetary, the material, the materialistic. And I wonder sometimes as to whether this faith is not almost entirely misplaced. Imagine if there was no oil shortage. Imagine if America had all the oil and all that oil represents it could possibly need. We had all the wealth, all the means of motion. We didn't need any rationing, any forms of control. Ought we not to be then by far the happiest, gayest, most joyous nation, group of people on the face of the earth? Well, that, dear friends, has been America's state for the last 25 years. We've consumed nearly half of the profit of the world. Has it made us the most joyous and happiest of nations? We consume more pills than any other nation. We go to more psychiatrists than any other nation. More of our marriages break up than in any other nation. We have more ulcers and more heart attacks and more wealth. Sometimes one can have more but have less because we are less. Yes, there's a great big world out there, and it's a cruel place, and we must make realistic and calculated decisions to provide for ourselves and our families. We cannot escape that world, but at the same time, there's a world in here. And we cannot escape this world. We can't shed it. It remains with us, wherever we go, whatever we do. And in this world, when we compromise with principle, we demean ourselves. And when we live by the code of the jungle, we cease to be human, feeling, sensitive, aware. America has paid a heavy price for its abundance. He's 20 years of age. He's been raised in a good home, in a good suburb. He's gone to a good school. He's been properly teethed and properly medicated and properly recreated and properly taught. And there's nothing in his mouth but bile and anger, because there's nothing in his heart but bile and anger. No one knows the truth but he and his little group of friends. No one is worth anything than a small group who come around him and share with him his views. Why not? But he's not yet been humanized. He's not been bruised by life. He's still full of the immortality of youth. He's a god, not a man. He's superior, not one of us. She's 40. She's a mother, married. She's had every advantage. She's lived out her maturity during the most prosperous times in the most prosperous country in the history of the world has known. And she too has had every advantage. A good home, a fine education, a husband who provides. She's been lucky her children are healthy. And now they're in school all of the day and time hangs heavy on her hands. Sport has lost its zest. Society is now an escape, not simply a pleasure. She doesn't know what to do with herself, and so she blames male chauvinism. She has enemies, scapegoats, because she's not at peace with herself. She's paying the price of American abundance because she's never had to settle down to do something which day in and day out would sanctify and consecrate her life. He's 50. Married. His children are grown. He's been successful in business. He's worked very hard. He's proud of himself. And he will not admit that so much of his success in business is due to the fact that he lived at a time in which it was possible to be successful in business. It's due to him. And so he's very confident and very arrogant. He can't understand why others don't see his point of view. It's obviously the only right point of view. He doesn't understand why his children are drifting farther and farther away from him. He doesn't know that he's pontificating. He's simply saying what obviously works. His life has narrowed. His children, his family have tended to move us away. His work has been all engrossing. And 15 years from now, his life will be utterly and totally empty. Because abundance has misled him to believe that the acquisition of wealth is an end in and of itself, the end in and of itself, which justifies life. Sometimes one can have more and be less. Sometimes one can have less and be more. The rabbis tried to illustrate the truth about life by the manufacture of oil in the ancient world. I go back to my symbol. We drill for oil and pump it up out of the ground from a fossil fuel. Their oil came from trees. They would take each harvest season a pole and beat the olive tree and pick up the olive fruit and place it in mortars, and then they would pound and they would press the fruit into a pulp until it gave off a clarified liquid, and it was this liquid that lit the lamps of ancient Israel. And the rabbis were impressed by the procedure, that you couldn't get light until you pressed and you pounded and you beat. And they thought back on Jewish history. And they said, you know, that's exactly the way that it was with Israel. When Israel was young, when the tribes first came into the promised land and they saw the wealth and the abundance of this land flowing with oil and with honey, they were greedy and they were eager. And for the first time in the history of Israel, there were divisions within the clan between the wealthy and the poor. The great landowners began to turn the poor people into serfs and into slaves. There was, for the first time, social injustice. Ultimately, there was fratricide, civil war. Ultimately, this greedy nation took over all the abominations of the Canaanites, to use the biblical words, which means simply all of the abominations of the affluent, and became less than strong, less than cohesive as a people. There was no longer a central purpose, and soon enemies were ravaging the land and carrying off the crops and ultimately conquering the cities and ultimately exiling the people, taking them captives. It wasn't, the rabbis observed, until Israel had been destroyed and the people taken into exile, that sense of community, that sense of compassion, that concern for learning and for understanding, those things which have been the hallmark of the Jewish people down through the long centuries, began to emerge. Until then, the prophets had reason to point the finger and damn and condemn. But once the people had been beaten and bruised by life, then they began to become human. And I suspect it's this understanding which allows me to be not that distraught by the rather gloomy predictions some of our economists are making about the future, in which they tell us that the oil shortage is only the first of innumerable shortages, shortages in minerals, shortages in foodstuffs, shortages in clean air and clean water, and that even the panaceas which science is providing for us, the great atomic energy plants which will supposedly provide us the fuel which will make up for lack of oil, will lack enough uranium in order to continue giving us the power for the motion and the abundance which we require. It's possible for us to know a lower standard of living without lowering the standard of our own awareness, without lowering the happiness which we can gain in life. And it's to that end that I speak to you tonight, because I'm convinced that the era of grossness, the era of incredible affluence is over. It's not only inflation. It's the simple fact that there are 3 billion earthlings and 200 million earthlings can no longer enjoy nearly half of the well-being of the prosperity of the world. They want more and they're going to get it. And we're going to have work harder and our standard of living will fall. Now generally when that happens, political shocks go out, shockwaves go out into the nation, and everybody falls to grabbing for the bone to get his share and more. And that may be the fate of America. For certainly there will have to be rationing controls on our liberties. And so many of us who have talked proudly about being champions of social and racial justice will suddenly hear ourselves saying quite other kinds of things, because now social justice will be spelt our promotion or our son's scholarship. Long as the pie was getting larger and larger, it was very easy to welcome others into our prosperity. But when the pie is getting smaller and smaller and we have to give up something for the other person to get something, it's not so easy to be a saint. It's possible that America will fall into a mood of self-pity and anger, look for scapegoats and find them. But it's also possible that you and I, searching our ancient tradition and ourselves, will find within ourselves a capacity to redefine a Shana Tova, the good life, and to recognize within ourselves skills, interests, feelings, emotions, which can be satisfied without cost, whether we live modestly or as wealthy men and women. That's the test which faces us in the years ahead. Have you wondered why there's been this cult of nostalgia sweeping the land? Among non-Jews in the Christian world, it's been a nostalgia for apostolic poverty, for the simple days of Jesus. They've had their Jesus Christ superstar, etc., as they tried to relive the simplicities of a rather primitive country society where natural goodness should shine forth. And we as Jews, we too have had our nostalgia. Fiddler on the Roof, the shtetl, Hasidism. Why? The shtetl was a grimy place. The shtetl was a poor place. The shtetl lacked all the amenities. None of us would want to live in the shtetl. It was cold. It was hard, it was rude, and at the same time we sense that in the shtetl our fathers had a possession worth far more than anything that we can purchase. What did they have? A sense of community, chant, warmth, song, a conviction, Torah, God, Israel. Somehow the oppressor, the pressing, the being beaten, had allowed them to extrude from their spirit the oil by which one lights the lamp of the soul and the lamp of the home and the lamp of the community. There was a bond of fraternity, a bond of friendship, the bonds of common purpose that we tend to lack, and whose lack we desperately feel in our ruggedly individualistic society, where every man and woman pursues his own material goal. The nostalgia is a way of reminding ourselves of those things which have value, which cannot be purchased as oil is purchased, which cannot be pursued as profit is pursued. And we have the institutions, the synagogue, the academy, the symphony, the library, the museum. We have all kinds of institutions ready to help us learn to live with less. Learn to live more gracefully than we live now with less. And we have the institutions, marriage, the family, the relationship of the generations, which can allow us to live more gracefully and more satisfyingly with less. But the test is in here. Are we willing to spend more time cultivating the ties of friendship? Are we willing to invest more of ourselves in our marriages, with our children, with our parents? Are we willing to spend more of our time enjoying the cultural, the creative, the intellectual possibilities which exist all around us? Or are we so conditioned by advertising, by the artificial stimulation of our appetites, that we can define happiness only in the crudest of terms? The biggest of cars, the fanciest of dress, the finest of homes, the most exotic of travel. I wonder. One of the 613 commandments in the Torah is Lakakta Shemen Zayit Zach Katit Lama'or Lahalot Ner Tamid. You shall take pure olive oil beaten for the light in order to light the eternal lights, to light the lights of the synagogue. As the times become more difficult, more pressing on all of us, have we the courage, the vision, this year, to invest more of ourselves in ourselves, to invest more of ourselves in our families, to invest more of ourselves in friendship, to invest more of ourselves in training ourselves to be creative in one field or another, to care, to share, and to serve. I wish you all a Shana Tova. I've not tried to preach tonight a sermon of renunciation. There is no glory in poverty. But I have tried tonight to preach a sermon which would suggest the varied, the many, the innumerable possibilities which exist within the context of your life and mine for happiness, for fulfillment, whatever be the exertions which life demands of us. By all means, may the new year be a sweet year and a prosperous year. But it can never be as prosperous or as easy for us as it has been in the last 15 or 20 years. Never again. The test for us is a test of whether we need to have more, even though it may mean that we are less, or whether we can learn to have less and at the same time be more. Amen.